Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
From A&E, the creators of Cold Case Files, comes your next true crime podcast obsession, PD Stories. Every week, law enforcement professionals join host Tom Morris Jr. from America's Most Wanted and Live PD to share their experiences, insights, and perspective on policing. You are not going to want to miss this show. Be sure to subscribe on Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and many other podcast apps so you can get new episodes every week. Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Seth Partnow of The Athletic and longtime guest of the show, and we have a really interesting conversation. Started out with the trade deadline and a little bit on the strategic planning session series that he, Sam Vecenie, and I are doing for The Athletic. And then we talk about Zion, uncertainty, a lot of other interesting topics over the course of the hour. This episode is brought to you by betonline.ag. Use that Podcast One promo code for a 50% sign-up bonus. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's been actually not that long this time.
Yeah, a little bit over a month from what I could tell. And we had talked about doing something in relation kind of to the trade deadline. And where I wanted to start is this, I feel like I have this weird sense of stability right now with kind of how I see the title picture. And some of that is, you know, norms and where, you know, like my, where I came into the season thinking things and maybe I'm just relying too much on my priors. But I was wondering kind of, we don't need to spend a lot of time on how you see the picture. What I'm more interested in is how fluid you see it and what could change where you kind of see the lines of division.
I mean, I thought before the season that there were kind of four teams that were right there, and I think that that's largely what we've seen so far. I mean, you know, take or leave, you know, Philly's been up and down, but I think, you know, we've talked about this offline, but, like, Philly's been up and down in sort of the way that, you know, that was a pretty predictable way for them to be up and down, and they're still, in terms of their kind of high-end possibilities against the best teams, I don't think we've seen anything to like downrate that. And then, you know, the things have worked out a little bit better for the Lakers, a little bit worse for the Clippers than maybe we thought coming in, but they're, I think, fairly clearly the class of the West right now. And then, you know, the Bucks are stomping everybody, so they there's not really a lot they can do to answer what criticisms there are of them in the regular season. So, but they're just, you know, there is this at this point regular season juggernaut that is positioned to have home court throughout the playoffs. So, yeah, it's almost like we're halfway through the season and nothing has changed in that regard.
Yeah, and an overall thing for me is that we had some of these positive stories in the early going, you know, like Miami, maybe still 31-13 as we record this, which is a really good record, but I think we're seeing signs that they're very good, but not in that same caliber as the Bucks and the Sixers. And then sort of the same thing in the West, you know, the Rockets and Nuggets, partially due to health, and especially in Denver's case, they've fallen off a bit. And so, yeah, I think the Lakers and Clippers are the class of the conference, and that could, you know, depending on structures and different things that are involved, you could see that kind of a 3.5 team top tier leading to an arms race at a trade deadline, depending on who's available. And that's something you and I have gotten into a little bit in our strategic planning session pieces. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But they're kind of, in order for a trade deadline to be really impactful, you need to not only have, you need to have buyers, you need to have buyers with assets, and you need to have willing sellers. And I feel like we don't have enough of all three to make this the trade deadline that would be more fun and explosive.
Yeah, we don't. There's not like the buyers that collectively don't have the draft assets because they used them all, and there aren't kind of the bad contracts floating around that can be used to sort of lubricate some of these deals that we've seen in the past. So it seems like just because of how short term a lot of the contracts around the league are, if for no other reason, it just seems it's been really hard. You know, you mentioned these strategic planning pieces we've been doing. It's been really hard to come up with deals that make sense for both sides because, you know, there might be a mutuality of interests, but then the mechanics of actually making it work just kind of aren't there.
it's also the case right now, and there are different theories maybe on why this is the case, that a lot of young players who could be the sweeteners in deals are actually important parts of their current teams. Like Tyler Hero, we brought this up, Miami is the most recent team we did for that session, you Sam, and me, I guess that'd be me, not I, is, like, so Tyler Hero is an intriguing player, you know, somebody who could be desirable for an NBA team, to, like, for a team to acquire. However, he's also an important part of the Miami Heat. And so are they willing to swap him out for maybe somebody who's more established? And, I mean, you could go there. You could go Tatum and Brown being integral parts of the Celtics. Matisse Thybulle looking like the sixth, maybe fifth man in Philly. And there just aren't as many of those intriguing young players who, you know, kind of like the Eric Bledsoes of the world. The guys who look, when he was on the Clippers, who look like they're going to be a good player, but they're maybe a little bit blocked, and they're on their way, but they're not at the same timeline. The top four teams this year just don't have many of those players.
Yeah, and you know, again, like, the Lakers used them all already, and you know, and another guy who might be sort of like that would be like Landry Shamet, and he's kind of a similar situation to Hero, right? Is he's pretty, especially given their the Clippers kind of dearth of spot up shooting, like he's a pretty important piece there. So yeah, you're right. It's just, again, there isn't a lot of ways to dip into for these teams to upgrade without swapping out, you know, important parts of their rotation. And then the guys that are available, it seems like, aren't of sufficient caliber to be worth the risks of taking a piece of your rotation out. I mean, maybe if, you know, some of the bigger name guys, whether it's, you know, it's that have been mentioned around, like a Chris Paul or a Drew Holiday, like, their contracts are so big that then you can't, you know, you can't. It's pretty hard to trade young players for Duralde, because how do you get to that? How do you get to the number? You know, and then now, because there aren't, you know, the non-productive salaries on these good teams now to grease that deal. So it's almost we have a lot of stasis right now.
I think the best example of that is Boston, and so the Celtics. They're one of the few of these teams that actually does have draft assets. They have that Memphis pick, which, you know, is looking a little bit worse by the day as the Grizzlies are doing well, and this draft is still uninspiring from the people who know it better than I do. But the Celtics have basically no matching salary. So there are only five on Boston who make more than $5 million. You have Kemba Walker, not getting moved. Gordon Hayward, challenging because he makes 32-7 and all the other stuff involved. Marcus Smart at 12-6, maybe. And then Tatum and Brown, who they're not moving. Brown they functionally cannot, and Tatum they will not. So Boston, they have this draft asset. They have motivation. I mean, the field is open enough that maybe conceptually they could add something which would make them more competitive. And we don't know where the East is going over the next couple of years, but maybe this is a pretty decent shot at it. Kemba's, you know, getting older. But it's hard for them to make a deal work, because how many players are available for, let's say, $10 million, good enough to move the needle for them to justify giving up that pick, and also available? Because, sure, there are players that good, but they're not going to be on the market.
Right. And so it's how do they get to, you know, are the names that were bandied about earlier, how do they get to Miles Turner? And, you know, would you swap Hayward for Miles Turner, you know, and with whatever else you need to balance on either side? I mean, regardless of the draft asset, like, would you even do that if you're Boston? It's not an easy yes,
especially because we know how scarce wings are, and they don't really have a clear way to replace Hayward in the rotation. I mean, they could. And this is an important distinction between a starting closing five and a roster, that they could, you know, plug Marcus Smart in, then you close with Kemba, Smart, Tatum Brown, and Turner, but who plays the rest of the minutes becomes a problem.
Right. And can Turner play in every matchup in the playoffs? Like, I there isn't a team that's going to play Gordon Hayward off the floor. Whereas I can, you know, it's There are matchups where, you know, you get into a series against Miami. I can see situations where there's just nobody for Miles Turner to guard, and you know, or that he's gonna have to, the matchups work out such that he's got to come out to the elbows and the top of the key and pick up Bam Adebayo, and then they just kind of, you know, run their vaguely Princeton-y stuff and endless backdoor layups with the only rim protector is standing 20 feet from the basket because he has to guard Bam Adebayo.
Yeah, or against the Bucks, you don't want him a mile away guarding Brook Lopez, so then congratulations, is Miles Turner guarding Giannis?
I mean, that's sort of the blueprint, but I don't think is Miles Turner stout enough
I don't think so.
To do that kind of Gasol Embiid kind of wall thing that you know, if you're talking about something that has been effective against him, it's been, you know, that the big guys with the physicality to not get, you know, knocked backwards by kind of the freight train Eurostep. And yeah, I don't think that's I think that, like, you know, you know, we're bouncing around a little bit, but of the Indiana, like, big guys, like, I kind of feel like Sabonis can almost do that better. And I don't think that matchup works either, but yeah.
Yeah. It's a real challenge. And I mean, another example, a name that we haven't brought up as much is Robert Covington. Covington would help a lot of teams. He's a defensively capable forward, though I do think that those who see him a defensively capable forward as a stopper, I don't think that's what Covington is, especially not against the most physically capable. He's more of a utility defender, kind of like Jason Tatum, actually, where he's better not on the main guy and just gumming up the works. And there's a place for that on a lot of different teams, and Covington is a willing three-point shooter, if not the most accurate all the time. And the problem is, Minnesota could use a guy like that too, and maybe not as much this year because they're falling off, and the eternally questionable Karl-Anthony Towns is now actually back in the lineup, which is great, but they, you know, they're probably too far out of it at this point unless they go on an absolute tear. So I think that's going to be a part of this too. So you have that component of it, of the players, because Covington's under contract for another couple of years. Maybe Minnesota thinks he can be a part of where they're going moving forward. But then the other one is, in the West especially, you have teams that could theoretically be sellers that are close enough to the playoffs where they might just not want to sell unless the price is exorbitant, which it won't be.
So who are, like, I mean, are you thinking San Antonio?
As a seller, or what are you talking about?
Yeah, as like a team that would that possibly would be, you know, because you think like Memphis, do they have? I mean, Iguodala, but that's sort of a different thing.
Yeah, that's a different thing because he's not playing for them. But like, so yeah. For Memphis, Jay Crowder would be an option. For the Pels, I mean, it's pretty clear to me that Jrue Holiday is not going to be on the market, and I don't think JJ Redick is either. Maybe Redick is one of the situations where a team asks about him, and they say, we're not, like we'll listen, but not expecting to do it, you know, that sort of a thing.
Josh Hart or Etuan Moore somewhere.
Yeah, maybe.
But are either of those guys, you know, the Lakers could possibly use Josh Hart.
And Gallinari. I mean, back, I mean, in the preseason, I thought Gallinari was one of the most likely players to be traded in the entire league because OKC, they're rebuilding. He's an expiring contract. They can do a lot of different things there. Could help them get below the tax. And while I think they could make the playoffs, even if they trade him for nothing tomorrow, that's the benefit of being where the Thunder are right now. I believe they're 7 games clear in the win column, 6 or 7 clear of the 8 of every other team, and they'd have to fall past 2 of them to get out. But then you have the other side of this. So the sellers, willingness of the sellers, but then who is falling all over themselves to get Gallinari? Again, I think he could help a number of different teams. He's a capable offensive forward, and he's flawed defensively, but he helps add to your rotation. But as the Thunder, what is enough? I don't think that a decent second-round pick is enough to get off of that. Maybe a second-round pick and a player who you think could help you long-term, but who's offering that? And that's not even a first.
And then on top of that, of course, you get the salary matching and then getting to the – so, yeah, exactly. Because there's the sort of the middle tier is so wide open – and you know, some guys who we thought might have been like more movable salary pieces are an important part of teams with playoff aspirations rotations.
And also the deadline being earlier now, it creates this long gap for the buyouts, and there could be players. I don't think somebody like Aaron Baines is going to get bought out, but it could be a circumstance where the Suns think they're more competitive on February 1st than they think they are on February 21st. And then that doesn't, it just makes things hard. And I mean, right now they're 18 and 26. They're in the mix. I mean, whether that's sustainable or not, we'll have to see. But they dealt with injuries and everything else. And Devin Booker has shown growth. He wrote about that very well at The Athletic. I think that was last week. And what do they do here? Like, so with Baines.
So this is to jump in there. This is like the pace at which things are moving. Like this time of year, that was yesterday.
Oh God, it was.
I know it seems like forever ago, and that was yesterday.
But you get what I'm saying with Baines?
Yeah.
And so you have the what would it take to get him? Is anybody willing to pay that? And I think both of those are really challenging. I think Baines, again, could help a lot of different teams. Incidentally, one of them they're not allowed to reacquire him would be the Celtics. I think he would be useful for them. But there are a lot of teams that could add Baines to their rotation and feel better about it. And I don't think any of them is going to cough it up because he doesn't move the needle enough for the title teams or enough for the tier two teams.
And also, this is where, like, the weirdness of where we are with, you know, with the contracts and stuff. We're kind of on you and Nate's corner now, but it's you know, Baines is expiring contract, and whoever would get him would only have, like, early bird rights, right? And would they have, correct me if I'm wrong, but they just have early birds, right? Hello? Did I lose you?
No, I was looking it up.
Oh.
So I believe actually they would have full, because what happened with Baines was he ended his previous contract with the Boston Celtics. And so he signed with them in 17, and then he signed with them in 18. So 17, 18, 18, 19, 19, 20, that would be full bird. Because he got traded, you retain rights in that circumstance.
Okay.
I think he would have full bird. I haven't run through it. This is me off the cuff doing bird rights calculations.
Yeah.
But I believe that it would be full, which is valuable for the Suns.
I feel like this scenario has come up with players before. But,
yeah. And but here's another. I've thought a little bit also the TJ Warren Suns revenge game just happened, about how interesting all of that turned out. So the Suns basically dumped TJ Warren. TJ Warren is doing very well for the Pacers, but they also got Aaron Baines in a salary dump from the Celtics, which also worked out well. Which worked out well for the Suns. It's so weird.
Yeah. So, but where that still leaves us with, you know, we're all dressed up and worried that there's going to be nowhere to go at the deadline this year.
Yeah, and I mean, Dallas is another example. I could see them. I could see a lot of moves on the margins. Dallas has the Barnes trade exception. Now they have a much greater need for a stopgap plus center, now that Dwight Powell unfortunately has the Achilles injury. And I basically think they should treat it as he's out for this year and next. That's probably the rational kind of pathway to go down. And but are they going to give up any sort of, not that they have a ton of them, premium asset to get a center when they already have all these other things and they have Kleba and Porzingis and everything else? But there are a lot of these kind of meh type of players who could inspire some interest. I brought up this idea on Nate and I did a Southwest preview pod, which came out on Thursday morning, about maybe if Mark Cuban's willing to spend the money, they could do something like Courtney Lee for Cody Zeller. And Zeller is really overpaid, you know, $15 million a year, not sure, you know, how much he moves the needle for a good team. But if it's Courtney Lee, the difference in cost this year is marginal, and Dallas was going to be over the cap next year. So maybe that sort of deal is the type of thing that happens.
Yeah, that's not exactly the exciting
Well, yeah, I mean,
if that was the big move at the deadlines, yay.
For example, like, I mean, my expectation right now is I don't think an all-NBA caliber player is getting moved. I could be wrong, but I don't expect it.
Well, I mean, they kind of all already got traded over the summer.
Right, and or re-signed or all that. I mean, the consequence of a very wide-open offseason like the Superfund one we just had is that they generally lead to less going on right after it. The analog to this for me is in the NCAA tournament, when there's a really upset heavy round, usually the next round is less interesting because the teams that had the upsets just lose. And I think that's sort of what this is that you have all this turnover, and now the teams are stabilizing, they're trying to figure out what the heck they have, and in certain cases there are restrictions, can't trade this guy, or it's functionally difficult. that combined with the contract structures that we have, which fuel from the same thing, that there was just a lot of guys that expired last year and everything else, that there isn't enough grease. And I think it's not a problem. It's just the way things are.
Well, I mean, the way I like to eat breakfast, not enough grease is definitely a problem. But yes, I
mean, considering the amount of words that we put on a Jordan Clarkson for Dante Exum piece, maybe it is a little bit of a problem.
Right. Yeah, so I don't know. I feel like we've talked a while about something that we've talked a lot about nothing. It's almost like a Seinfeld episode. Trade deadline.
Plenty more to talk about with Seth, but first a message from betonline.ag. The Super Bowl matchup is set, including my San Francisco 49ers. They're facing the Kansas City Chiefs, but this is a weekend without football, so that means basketball takes center stage. You have some great college matchups, and also in the pros, Lakers, Sixers, Clippers, Heat will be pretty exciting. Whatever you're into, or if you want to make early wagers on the Super Bowl, you can do it at betonline.ag. Use that Podcast One promo code for your 50% sign-up bonus. Whether it's a game that you're going to be watching anyway and you just want to make it more interesting, or you think you know something that the odds makers do not, you can do both of those things at betonline.ag. You can also check out in-game wagering, which is so interesting, something I've gotten into a little bit over the last little while. And they have a lot of other things. If you're into some other branch of sports, there's a lot that you can check out at betonline.ag. But make sure that if you go there and you're setting up an account, that you use the Podcast One promo code that gives you a 50% sign-up bonus. Also, of course, tells them that you came from us, which is great for this show. So check out betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts. Let's transition to a lot about a very small sample size. Zion Williamson just played in his first regular season NBA game, and it looked a lot less remarkable before he scored 17 consecutive points in the fourth quarter. It is neither of our natures to go overboard with any single game or any single quarter, but what did you take away from night one?
I don't think there's much that can happen in that one game to change your prior belief too much. I mean, I think it's obvious that his conditioning and rhythm isn't where it needs to be. I mean, I think anyone who watched him summer league preseason at Duke, he's usually a little more active than he was last night. But at the same time, there's still even before that big run in the fourth quarter, there were still a couple of wow moments. There was the climbing all the way over Jakob Poeltl to get a rebound, and then the frozen rope of a hit ahead pass for a layup. It was just kind of a wow play. There's one in the first half where he kind of faced up on Aldridge and just like did a little rip through move and exploded by him baseline. And just those few kind of instances of just like the easy shot out of a cannon athleticism. It's like, okay, yeah, that's going to be fine. And then it's just a matter of him getting his timing and his wind back. It's not, you know, they, I don't want to talk too much about the broadcast, 'cause I'm being accused of being, you know, old man yelling clouds about it. Not that I ever do stuff like that. They made some mention of his weight, and yeah, maybe, sure, but it's much more just the conditioning, just basketball shape. The guy hasn't played in 4 months, 5 months. And, you know, it's just, it, a lot of kind of the he wasn't really very good defensively last night. But that's just, you know, if you've ever not played for a while and then played, you're just heavy footed. And so those instant, oh, I see what's happening, I got to go plays just don't happen when you're heavy footed. And that's something that I think, you know, give it 2 weeks. And if it still looks like that, then maybe worry. But again, you don't do the kinds of things he did in college and in preseason without having some degree of awareness and burst and stuff like that.
The play that sticks in my mind was also involved Jakob Poeltl. It was the play when Poeltl blocked Zion on the left side of the basket, and somehow Zion caught the ball and was on the right side of the basket before anybody could react. And he, you know, that broad jump that he has, the jump stop, well, Nate uses the broad jump, the jump stop, which he didn't actually use that much in this game, or special, and they're special among freak athletes too. Like he can do those sorts of things, and I think as you said, the idea of being heavy-footed, being a little bit rusty, you know, it's, there's a big jump that every player goes through into the NBA. And, I mean, he played in the preseason and in summer league a little bit. But those are different things. And those adjustments, combined with coming back from a surgery, is a lot. And I think that unless they waited long enough for him to be 100%, which he is, at 100% and, like, you know, physically and also non-rusty physically, then that probably would have been a long time from now. And they obviously don't want that, and it's totally fine. That's why you have to pull him in the fourth quarter and all that jazz. But I thought that the signs overall were positive. And the passing, as you brought up, I think that was material to me because it was something that really impressed me on film. And he's just a tantalizing player, and Zion is tough because he's a challenging fit on both ends of the floor. To me, he's best with the ball in his hands, and that's harder mechanically to do for a guy his size. And then defensively, at this point, he's probably a man without a country, and that could change. I hope and expect that it will in time. So fitting him into a team, any team, much less one like this New Orleans squad that has a lot of really different players on it, was always going to be a challenge.
Yeah, although I do think, I mean, kind of the difference between being a man without a country defensively and being really versatile. I mean, I think that's just a where you set the bar. I mean, I think the in shape version of him is much more on the versatile defender side than on the no place to go side. So again, I think that's we're going to, you know, for the people who are high on his potential, that's a big part of it, is the ability to you know, guard multiple different scenarios and situations well. And when he's, you know, doesn't have his full capabilities because of his wind, you just don't see that yet. So I think that's going to be that part's going to be maybe a work in progress for the next couple of weeks. But I think that's the kind of thing that we actually should expect to be again, if you're an optimist, you expect that to be a strength rather than a weakness.
There's also a corresponding element on the other end of the floor, and it's part of why I've been so high on Zion throughout this process, and a little bit different than somebody like Anthony Davis, who I loved as a prospect, where the question which is basically at the heart of why I think Zion's special, is what positional archetype do you have guarding him? Because I think we saw it a little bit last night that when a team puts a center on him, Zion has more ball handling, he's faster than a lot of those guys, and he has good passing instincts. So if he generates help, if he generates churn, then he can do something with that. And if a team puts a smaller player on him, you know, the idea, let's say like somebody like Kristaps Porzingis, where you put somebody smaller on him because Porzingis doesn't have the tools in his toolbox to punish those players, Zion does. He really does, not only as a, you know, because he's such a big body and he's good at backing guys down, but also because he's a good passer. And those things fit together. And there was not enough of a sample in Wednesday's game to, like, prove that or anything. But I think we got a couple moments that were reminders of why that is the case.
Sure. I actually thought for a moment that you're going to go where, like, what do you put a guy like Kristaps Porzingis on him? And then doesn't he just put, like, Porzingis under the basket and you know, go through them, but that's not where you're going with it. It's just that almost illustrates that the, you know, some of the post up foibles, like that, the play you mentioned about the Poeltl play. Part of the reason that worked is he was able to just, like, basically run straight at Poeltl, stick a shoulder into him, reverse pivot, and okay, I've got you sealed behind me 6 feet from the basket. And yeah, Poeltl was able to block the initial shot, but he's already so deep that the second effort is a layup. And that's, you know, that's the contrast that with a guy who's tall and skinny, who, well, I'm going to reverse pivot and you're going to bump me in the back and I'm going to catch the ball at 17 feet. And now what happens? And so that's, again, that's and Zion seems like he's probably got the ability to, you know, get deep position on pretty close to anybody. You know, maybe not like a, you know, maybe not like an Embiid or a Gasol or a really big thick center like that, but anyone else up and down the positional spectrum, like you can go there and get churn, as you said, in a defense, because I don't think there's a defense in the world that if a guy catches the ball with 1 or 2 feet in the paint is not going to react to that.
Exactly. And if and shooting 4 of 4, making 100% of his threes is not going to continue necessarily moving forward, considering it doesn't appear Zion had hit 4 threes in his life in any other game. But if he can get to a jump shot that teams have to respect, that creates another set of opportunities. I mean, Zion, one of the ways that teams try to attack players who can't shoot is just by sagging off them. But A, Zion could be a really destructive screener just by virtue of his massive humanity. But also, if he can combine that with handling the ball, as he can, and combining that with potentially some sort of jump shot, then it will take some work, and I think Alvin Gentry is a pretty good fit for how to create that offense, but I do think that it is creatable with the right supporting talent and the right scheme.
So this is the interesting thing we bring up about the jump shot. He is not a good shooter. He's not a non-shooter. The big thing for him, it's a little bit like Ben Simmons in that the free throw shooting is actually going to be a pretty big swing skill there, because even to a greater extent than Simmons, I think, is the issue with kind of giving space to Zion is that lets him get ahead of steam and go to the basket, and he'll go to the free throw line a ton. And if he's shooting, you know, he shot 64% in college his 1 year, that's probably just good enough. Where that unto itself is a good offense, and that's a way to take advantage of that kind of defensive inattention. And also, unlike Simmons, who occasionally seems like he doesn't want to get fouled because he's not a good shooter, I don't think we've ever really seen that from Zion. So if he's willing to get to the line, you know, 12 times a night and go 7 of 12, you know, I don't think you can profitably guard him that way.
Another player who has long been sabotaged by appearing to not want to go to the free throw line is his current teammate Lonzo Ball. And Ball has gotten a little bit more confident there. I thought he actually showed some strides in the Spurs game as well. And it can infect the rest of a player's game in so many ways. And I'm not as worried about that with Zion, both from seeing him play in college and a little bit in high school. But it is a very good thing to note, not only in terms of defensive strategy, but in terms of offensive mentality.
Yeah, exactly. That just, you know, the whole notion of if you take penetration away as a threat, because either you can't finish, or if you get fouled, you can't make free throws, and you know you can't make free throws, so you don't try to get fouled. And then that affects your finishing, because instead of, like, you know, seeking bodies out and kind of dictating how you're going to try to finish, you're kind of fading away. And you know, it's one of the things that they teach is that, like, one of the best ways to you know, go at a shot blocker is to literally go at the shot blocker. If you actually give them space to take up, then they become even, you know, in a way, even bigger. Whereas if you go right at them, you take away some of their ability to be big. That sounds nonsensical, but it makes sense in my head.
Well, it also ties in with one of the worst things you can do against them is basically give them the victory without even trying. And I was, during the Zion game, I was at Chase Center for Warriors Jazz when every single Warrior was terrified of Rudy Gobert. And then and this is something that you did some really good work on now in calculus and various other people as well, is that the impact many times defensively of a center is not by the shots they block, but by the shots they change and the shot decisions they change.
Yeah, no, it's very rare for someone to the situations where if you get the ball close to the basket and it's not a good decision to try to score. In most situations, that's, like, even the most heavily contested attempt is still an above league average shot. Except, like, you're a small guy and Rudy Gobert's there. Or, you know, you're a small guy and Brooke Lopez is there. Or one of these elite, well, or Joel Embiid, one of these elite rim protectors are there. And that kind of changes that almost changes the entire way you play defense. You that's what it's meant when you hear commentators talk about a defense funneling guys to a shot blocker, is you know what, we're going to take the jumper away because you can beat us to the basket and it doesn't matter because that's a bad shot also because our big guy's back there. And that's you know, that is a tremendous floor raiser for a defense to have a guy like that. This allows you to be much more aggressive, and aggressive without necessarily requiring a lot of help in rotation. on shooters.
Bucks here. And I was thinking about that and the idea of funneling and everything else, and as much as I like him as a prospect, is it possible that that could be a reason that we're overrating Bam Adebayo's defensive potential a little bit? Because while he is good at many things, that is not really his strength. So you have to build a defense differently, and you can't. There are many ways to build a successful defense, but one that is pretty tried and true right now is so different from what Miami does.
I think so. Bam is an interesting case because this was held true in college as well. He wasn't quite the dominant rebounder, rim protector you might have expected in college. But I think that that's his, in a way, his mobility and versatility is playing against him in that way, because he can get all over the court and guard. You're tempted to have him go all over the court and guard, which is great. But it does put him in different spots than these traditional kind of paint bound centers who are, you know, basically playing as a goalie. I mean, it's almost more of a libero role. If you remember some old school soccer fans might remember, where a team's like sweeper would wait, I can start back here and then I can come into play. And that's almost like Adebayo plays that way defensively, whereas, you know, some of these other guys are much more stay at home types. And so, but that allows him to, you know, put pressure on offenses elsewhere on the floor, but it necessarily means he's around the basket less, and so is able to affect shots at the rim less. And then also, he's, you know, Adebayo is probably about 6'9", and he's got decent wingspan, but he's still about 6'9". And so he's probably not, even when he's there, he's probably not quite the deterrent that some of these real Goliaths are.
Yeah, and I love Bam, and there are ways to make any system work. Miami has done well defensively, not actually in some ways as well as I expected. Something we talked about in the strategic planning session, in terms of they're below the top 10 and they're getting some intense opponent 3-point shooting luck. Well, actually, let's just use this as a transition. You and I and Sam Vecenie, in various different configurations, have been talking about team building and the league for a long time, and I think it was probably you and I originally, though honestly the three of us were talking about it again in various configurations, just decided to take some of those conversations, flesh them out a little bit, and turn them into pieces for The Athletic.
Yeah, it's been those have been fun, and those I think have really informed both all three of our opinions that this might be a quiet deadline, just because we're spending, you know, thousands and thousands of words trying to construct deals that make sense and kind of who says no? Well, that team says no. What if we change it this way? Well, then I say no. And just finding how many more obstacles there are to kind of natural partnership deals than there maybe have been in times in the past.
Very true. And I mean, we ran into that a lot in the Miami stuff. And when I'm getting down to Thomas Satoransky trades, you know, you're digging deep. But it also, for me, it's been clarifying as a way to talk about the discussions that go into really planning out where a team should go. So with Miami, for example, that was the one that was just released, we had to start with how good are they actually? Because that informs how aggressively you go after the present, whether you focus on the future. And I mean, so we talked about flexibility and all that, but there was a real discussion there in terms of, is their defense for real? Is their offense for real? How does it work against high-level opponents? You had some really good stats on that. And it's, I'm happy that it's getting, you know, it's been in the discourse to an extent before, but I'm really happy that we can put that in. And yeah, I mean, I guess if people are willing to read the 6,000 to 8,000 words that these pieces are turning into, then that's something. But a part of it is these conversations, if you were in the Heat front office, that's how you have to do it too, because you can't just start at, what about Robert Covington? You have to be like, well, what would that do for us? Where are we now?
No, I mean, this, you know, our Heat piece was, I'm looking at it now, was 7,536 words. The equivalent of that in discussion time for the trade deadline in an actual front office is several multiples of that. And, you know, looking at, you know, in far more granular detail of the nuance of you know, that what any particular idea would do your cap sheet, like what you know, planning out, you know, at this point, you know, planning out like what do we think Tyler Herro's extension is going to look like in 3 years. Like just ballparking that, just to see where we are. Like, what are we gonna do? Like, what are we? How do we feel about keeping Kendrick Nunn and Duncan Robinson around? What does that? What does that cost? What, you know? What? What is our? What is our kind of? What? What's the state of our discussions about, you know, Justice Winslow? What, you know, all of these things, you know, feeding in together. And then on top of that, it's, you know, you have a sense of. All right. Are we, you know, is Goran Dragic a piece of our plans going forward? And then what are the pros and cons of that? If it's, you know, okay, if he's not going forward, is it worth keeping him around this year, or are we better off, you know, putting him in a deal to do something or other? And then, you know, just all of these permutations are just, you know, fold back in on themselves endlessly. And that's kind of, that's what you do in the two months leading up to the deadline. You know, you have a pretty decent idea of where you are as a team pretty quickly into the season. And then okay, now it's mid-December. What do we do for the next 6 weeks? And yeah, you scout college games and blah, 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 but it's also like figuring this kind of stuff out. And then, so when it comes time to, and John Hollinger and I talked about this in our conversation last week, it all runs together still. But you've done that preparatory work, and now you have a base of, okay, here's about where we think we are. Here's about what we need. What's out there, that how does what's out there match our needs and assets, and you know, which parts are we most willing to compromise on? So, you know, so we went long on those, but you know, that's a fraction of the time that's actually spent on these decisions.
And it's also, I mean, another important part of this, just due to the nature of conversations, not that the information is held throughout the organization, but probably with one person, is that while a lot of trades and conversations are surprising to even, you know, members of the media once a trade is announced, those can be, though they are not always, built on things that have been discussed before, you know, maintaining relationships and all that sort of stuff. And also, one of this came up recently, the ways to predict things that are going to happen is by looking at pre-existing general manager trade relationship type stuff, because teams that are comfortable, that don't get swindled or whatever, they end up doing more business together because they're talking more.
Yeah, no, these in general, these things do not come together on a whim. They are, you know, usually subject to lengthy preparatory conversations. That's before even any kind of concrete offers are out on the table. So there's just a lot of swirling around and throwing stuff up against walls and whiteboarding and erasing and all that stuff that goes on. And then you realize, no, we're nowhere, and you start over again, which is kind of the experience we've had doing these preview pieces for the deadline.
It is. And also the thing, like, I mean, we had people, there was somebody in my mentions recently asking if we're going to do one of these for the Pelicans, and they are an interesting team, but my instinct on it was, I don't want to do them soon because I need to learn a lot more. And that can sometimes be a challenge too. I mean, Zion is an extreme of a midseason addition, but there can be them all the time. And knowing what you have is an extremely important part of deciding where to go. And that can be as basic as, what does this guy do well? What do you want to put next to them? Or it could even be, do we know how good this player is? Do we know where he's going to be in 3 years?
I think that more mistakes and bigger mistakes are made in the self-assessment process than in looking at what other teams have. I think, you know, overvaluing, misvaluing what you have, overstating where your team is relative to contention, overestimating the length of your window. All of these things are, you know, there's kind of some natural cognitive biases that play into all these things. But those mistakes are the ones that tend to get teams in trouble, and not just in trouble in terms of like making a bad deal at one time, but in terms of of locking a franchise in to oh wait, how did we get here? What's our way out? Which is, you know, kind of a good way to tease the fact that the next one of these that we're working on is for the Detroit Pistons, they certainly aren't in a disastrous situation like maybe the Knicks have found themselves a time where they're terrible and their cap sheet is befouled for several years hence, but like, you know, by the various moves, you know, a couple million extra here, an extension that was too rich there, going all in for Blake Griffin and then him breaking down physically, you know, all of these things kind of roll together means a team that is nowhere and doesn't have a ton of immediate future upside.
Yeah, there's another challenge. Nate and I recorded, but has not yet been released. It'll be released around the same time as this. Our young cores at rankings for Dunked On, and something we talked about towards the end was the difference between an empty cupboard and a full cupboard, and how there are ways to get, you know, like kind of more replacement level and above replacement level talent, you know, for the mid-level exception or things like that. But building out what will become the foundation for a successful team, however a team defines success, you know, that could be consistent playoffs, that could be getting a banner, making a conference finals, whatever that is. It's extremely hard to do, first and foremost. It is also almost always takes a lot of time. And I think that was in some ways, the part of the process that I hope was the best for the discourse, is that remember how long it took the Sixers to build up that cupboard. And there were a few missed draft picks, just like there are for any team. But, you know, they were bad for a while. And there are teams like the Rockets that can be the exception that proves the rule, and they were able to get a superstar for non-superstar pieces. But those trades are few and far between. And most teams, you know, like up with the Pistons, like that's going to be something that comes up. And at least my part of the write-up is it's going to take a while.
Yeah. No, but then the flip side is there's, you know, this, and I'm hardly the first to make this point, but you know, then there's something like Memphis. They get like kind of bad for a year or two, and then oh wait, we have Jaren Jackson, John Morant, Brandon Clark, D'Anthony Melton, Dylan Brooks, and all the cap space. Let's go. Like that's, you know, that's sometimes it just works out that way, and it's and you know, their new front office has done some smart things, but at the same time, like, you know, okay, we got the second pick in a two-player draft. Jaren Jackson is hitting the high range of his potential, especially as a shooter. The questions that people had about Brandon Clark's college productivity translating to the NBA, given his kind of positional weirdness, appear to be resolving in our favor. Like, you know, it's that's, you know, you take what you hope are smart gambles, and then you look like a genius if they all work out, but it didn't have to go that way.
Right. As an example here, the teams with the three worst records last season, Knicks, Cavs, Suns. How differently would the conversation look around any of those teams if they had gotten the number one or the number two picks?
Right. But yeah, I think even just the, like, you know, take the number one pick out, even just the number two pick, like how much different do any either of those teams look, and do we feel about their future if they have John Morant right now?
Exactly. Like, and not only getting a top for Memphis, getting a top two pick in a two-player draft that had a better two players than it looks like from what I've heard this year does. And, you know, and it's not even like the Grizzlies got bad. They were 33-49. They just won the lottery along with the Pels. And that's kudos to them. And also, I want to give both those front offices a lot of credit for making good moves on the margins. I thought that the way Memphis treated their trade exceptions and basically valued the spending power they had was really well done. David Griffin extracted basically the maximum for Anthony Davis that he could have. So they did a lot of other things that worked out well.
Only he had held up for Kuzma.
Oh, yeah. Kuzma would be a great fit with this Pelicans team. And yeah. And so I think that there is an which also, like, think about the hilarity if my theory of the case is right, that the Lakers, they probably asked for Kuzma, and the Lakers are like, oh no, let's give up extra first to get rid of, to keep Kuzma, and David Griffin could have gone, sweet. Like, you know, basically, like, we got what we wanted because you valued Kuzma more, because he was the one who didn't make sense as salary filler and everything else. And Yeah, so I mean, the Pelicans would be a positive story. They were a positive story before Zion even came to the fore. They were, you know, in playoff contention in the West. However, we're defining the value of that when it's gunning for like a 38-win season. But they would look really different if they hadn't moved from the seventh best odds to the number one pick. And there is an element of that that is in play. Also, it's very interesting to see how lottery reform affects the way teams think about all these things. And it's a real challenge. And I mean, part of the joy of sports is that there are a lot of different forms of uncertainty. There is the uncertainty of who's going to win the draft lottery. There's the uncertainty. I'll use the Pelicans for a bunch of these. Like that Brandon Ingram, you know, like there were people who thought when he was pretty good and he was young that all of us, that he's guaranteed to start up. And then many of those people were probably disappointed with how things went. And then now that he's blossomed more, significantly more than before, that was uncertain too. And it's like, that's part of what makes sports fun, but it also in some ways is part of what makes our jobs challenging, because like Victor Oladipo becoming the most improved player out of all those rides that he did, sometimes you just have to appreciate the ride for what it is.
Yeah, this is, so I'm glad you used the term uncertainty. On my podcast with Dave DeFore and Mo Dakhil, we played a clip from Paul DiPodesta, who's the vice president of something for the Cleveland Browns. I'm not sure exactly how like titles in football organizations translate.
Should I call him previously the guy who Jonah Hill played in Moneyball?
Yeah, exactly. And that's just very unkind to poor Paul, who was, you know, the captain of the Harvard football team, and here you get played by Jonah Hill now. So, but he had when they were announcing their new coach, who has an NBA connection, who is the son of Ed Stefanski, who is the interim until he finds someone better GM of the Pistons. That's a search that might go on for a while. But in the process of announcing that, he had about a 40-second clip where he's talking about like how to best operate in uncertainty. And that's the way we have to think about these things, because it's not, you know, you don't know, you know, like there's risk factors for all these guys. Like given his injury history just at Duke, there was injury risk with Zion, and maybe, you know, having the surgery right on the eve of the season, maybe that's, you know, rolling snake eyes a little bit there, but that's still, that's certainly a known risk and probably a higher than average risk for him, but doesn't mean you don't take him first. It just means that that's part of the uncertainty of okay, how will this 18-year-old progress as an NBA player? And just finding ways to give yourself the best chance for all that to work out. I mean, if everything works out exactly as you planned it, then there's no problem. But, you know, that how often does that happen? How often do things fall neatly into place exactly how you hoped and wished they would?
As an example of that, I mean, I'm guessing there was a part of Danny Ainge that thought when they got all those really high picks from the Nets that some of those would be converted into like maybe an MVP caliber player. Maybe he thought they got that in Kyrie Irving. And then Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown end up being important parts of a team that in a weird year made the Eastern Conference Finals and that is competitive right now in the Eastern Conference. And, you know, it's not exactly how his plan was going to go, but he had the versatility in it to make it work and that he actually believed in his board. I mean, the Fultz-Tatum trade is a pretty amazing one that I heavily criticized him for at the time and was, for complicated reasons, completely wrong.
I mean, well, were you wrong or just has it worked out? Like, that's the hard part in evaluating these decisions in retrospect.
Yeah, that's true.
Were you wrong or
Tatum is better than I thought he would be. So that part of it.
Okay.
Yeah, that part of it. And the Fultz stuff, I think, at least it was unforeseeable in ways that I consider unforeseeable. I know there were people who had concerns about his makeup and stuff, but I don't know. His situation is so anomalous that I don't really know what to take from it.
And that's a fairly extreme example, obviously.
It's about as extreme as it gets.
Right. But, you know, it's. Go back to the decision that was made at the time and were they right to make that decision at the time, knowing what was knowable then? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, and remember that the Kings pick, which was an important part of that, became a lot less valuable
right
after the fact too, though
Right.
And this is a theory that I have now, which is unprotected picks are more valuable about a year before they actually convey. So, like, you know, and the Kyrie thing didn't work out as well as they'd hoped and all that. But really, because what happens is there's this idea of, oh, it could be anything. And then once you get closer to it actually conveying, usually teams have that much time to figure it out. They'll get a little bit closer. And, you know, it's not going to every time happen. You know, the Kings were better last year in terms of record than they probably will be this year. And that's not going to happen every time. But I don't know. It's an idea that I think is worth pursuing.
Sure. No.
One last thing I wanted to ask you. I've ended podcasts on this a lot this year. We're, you know, 2 weeks from the trade deadline, but that's not the only thing on our minds. What are you looking for? You know, you can prioritize whatever you want for writing purposes, for podcasting, obviously, as well. What, you know, just as somebody who watches the league for a living, what teams are you focusing on? Are there any players, probably other than Zion, that you're going to be focusing on over the next 2 weeks to a month?
Trade deadline related, there's a couple of teams in the East that, you know, I think Miami, Boston are the kinds of, I don't want to say one piece away, but like you fill a hole and they suddenly become a much more intriguing, like playoff foible type team. So just heading into the deadline, seeing if it doesn't seem super likely, but if either of those teams are able to kind of pull it off. And then in the West, kind of seeing if a team like Denver, like if the seeming emergence of Michael Porter Jr. gives them kind of another level. If Utah's found something, or they're just on they're on a nice run that's possibly schedule-aided. Seeing if those teams can you know solidify themselves into that. If not tier one status, at least kind of tier one B. Those are kind of the things I'm looking at. And then it's just, you know, for the top 3.5 to 4 teams, it's much more like who stays healthy. And then, you know, it's hard to feel like we're learning a ton about any of those teams. Maybe Philly figures something out about how to have, you know, Simmons and Embiid coexist in a way that makes their offense make more sense. I'm not holding my breath on that, but maybe that's the one thing that's kind of out there that seems like it would, you know, raise not necessarily their ceiling, but raise their floor and median outcome some. So those are the things I'm looking at more. And then just kind of seeing if, some of the progress we've seen in some of these young guys is real. Is Devin Booker gonna play the way he's played thus far all year? Is he gonna be able to maintain, you know, that efficiency despite, you know, still having a really high usage? Is Brandon Ingram, is his shooting gonna tail off? Is he going to? That's kind of one of the takeaways from last night. Is he kind of struggled last night? And this is one game. You don't want to make too much of it, but you know there people were asking the question going into the game. How is Brandon Ingram going to fit back in now that Zion's back on the team? And Zion's not like super ball dominant, so it doesn't necessarily have to be a problem, but maybe it will be. But just seeing if, like, you know, the guys who seem to have taken a step up can maintain it for a full season. So I think those are the things that I'm mostly looking for.
I'll echo a lot of those. I mean, for me especially, of the ones you talked about, the Jazz and the Pelicans are going to be notable. The Jazz, how much of this is real? How do they integrate Mike Conley? Now that he's healthy, it becomes harder to, you know, play him less. How do they reconcile this lineup stuff? And then for me, the other big one, the two big ones. One, Detroit, that's not as much on the court because the product is not super watchable right now. But how do they approach this deadline? We're going to talk about that in a strategic planning session coming up. Because they're one of the few unambiguous sellers, but they have some important decisions to make. I think that's going to be telling for Stefanski and the front office and Dwayne Casey to an extent as well. And then the other one is Memphis. And so for me, how good are they? How much of this is repeatable? How do they handle the deadline? Not only in terms of somebody like Iguodala, who's not playing for them, but Jay Crowder. And they have a couple of pending restricted free agents that are going to be challenging negotiations, though this might be exactly the right year to have them. And how aggressively so because when a team has a lot of flexibility, I've talked about this before, I get obsessed with teams like where it looks like Memphis is going, because when a team is better than anticipated and has a lot of flexibility, it can go really, really well, or it can go really, really badly. And I thought Memphis was going to be poor, was going to be bad enough that those decisions weren't going to be as difficult. But if they're on the fringes of playoff contention, if Ja looks like he's the real deal, then this gets a lot harder, and they might become a large focus of mine in my work in April, May, and June.
Like, it's sort of a cliche. You can't skip steps. And then so determining, like, which you know, I'm going to run the metaphor into the ground a little bit, but which step are they actually on? You know, if they're on step two of the ladder, then they can't go to step four. But if they're actually on step three, then that's the next step. And kind of figuring out which one of those it is that's always tough. And I feel like we've seen more teams, again, kind of optimism bias gets the better of more teams than not in that sort of situation.
Yeah, the middle rungs are the hardest because the margins can be confusing. It can be more on luck and random chance. And because, especially if a front office drafted those players, they're going to want to believe the best of it because they're the ones who chose them in the first place.
Yeah. No, but that's again the hard part for Memphis is, okay, we know John Morant is good, but like how good are we penciling him in for? Are we thinking he's top 10 player in the NBA good, top 25 good, top 45 good? Like those are meaningful differences. And you know, yeah, he's got some equity to get all the way to the top, but we're like being really honest with ourselves if we're Memphis, where's the most likely spot that he ends up? And that has just a huge impact on how they perceive things. I mean, if they think he is an all NBA first team level player, like you do different things. I think that would be a pretty big call to make at this point. And you know, it certainly could be, but man, penciling him in to be that level of player going forward would be a step. And I think a lot of teams take that step and then just, you know, law of averages, most of them are wrong. And then, you know, you're overextended for a 48 win team. And that's, you know, that's why you see these teams rise up and never really get over the top so much.
Yeah, it is a definite challenge and one that we'll keep an eye on. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Seth for taking the time. You can, of course, read his excellent work at The Athletic. You can listen to the Nerder She Wrote podcast that he does, which was talked about a little bit on the show. And you can follow him on Twitter at Seth Partnow, SethPartnow. Love having him on. And this is a good time to have him on to think about the deadline. And we talked a little bit. You should read the piece they did with John Hollinger about what it's like in a front office, actual front office for the deadline. I'll probably focus a little bit less on that for Real GM Radio moving forward until the deadline actually passes. And I'll probably do something on that. We'll see how it works out. But you can, get that dunked on. We did previews division by division of the big potential movers and shakers and all that kind of stuff. And we will do the mock trade deadline, but mock trade deadline will be soonish. And you can look forward to that. If you want to support this show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe and download every episode. That's very important for metrics and everything like that. And to get into a rhythm, because Real GM Radio comes out at different times each week. It depends on my availability and guest availability. So can't say, oh, Thursdays I'm going to check in, see if it's there. It's going to be at different times each week. Can also spread the word of mouth is very much appreciated if that's a single episode or the series in general. If there's somebody you think would like it, please share that. And leaving a rating, leaving a review in the podcast, whatever you're choosing, that is always much appreciated and a way that people can help find the show and help other people find the show. But the most important thing for this show and any other that has them is to check out our sponsors. BetOnline.ag and that Podcast One promo code get you a 50% sign-up bonus and tell them that you came from us. There will, as always, be a Real GM Radio episode next week. I do not know exactly what the focus of it will be. I have a few ideas in mind and have a few guests that I've reached out to, and we'll see if any of them can commit. If you have any feedback on this show, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. I don't promise I'll respond, though I do try to, but I have them go to a separate place in my inbox, and I read all of them, because it's very important to me. So thank you so much for listening. Take care, and make it a great day.